Hello, and welcome to Ask Dr. Dawn. The opinions expressed in this program are those of the speakers, and this is a program intended for education and entertainment. It should not be construed as a substitute for a medical consultation. Well, tonight we have a special treat. We have some unscripted dialogue. First, I want to introduce our special guest tonight live in the studio. We have here at K-Squid headquarters, Sherry Bianchini. She is the CEO and owner of The Healthy Way in Santa Cruz. Sherry has been an RN for 40 years. She has a master's in public health. And she also was the head ICU nurse at Stanford for many years before seeing the error of her ways and moving into health promotion rather than the Hail Mary pass. So for 34 years, she has, she founded and has supported and nurtured and grown just a marvelous little local community asset called Healthy Way, which helps people learn to eat and behave in ways that promote their health. Sherry, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Well, you're very welcome. Go ahead and tell us a little bit about how many people have you seen at Healthy Way? I think you said something like thousands of people. How many thousands?
Well, over 10,000 people, I'm proud to tell you, in 34 years.
Wow, that's a lot of people.
That's a lot of people.
A lot of people that you've helped. And tell us a little bit about the program and how it's different from other programs.
Well, when I was born, the nursery nurses called me chubby, and I was 7 pounds, 12 ounces, so I feel like I was, you know, tagged at birth. Butterball, I think is what they exactly called me. And so over the years, you know, I'm a tall woman, big woman, and I've always struggled with my weight. And so after working at Stanford and really being in the illness model, I just thought, oh my goodness, can't we do something to get people, you know, to prevent, you know, before they wind up in the ICU. And so that's kind of how the Healthy Way was born, because I thought of my struggle with weight all these years and how it impacts health. And so I just took every program I'd ever been on and just different strategies that worked. And essentially that's how, you know, it's also been a labor of love, and it's been continually being recreated over the last 34 years. I mean, it started out, well, always blood sugar stabilization has always been our cornerstone. But it's continued to, but we've added, you know, so many more things. We offer weight and lifestyle solutions, and we know people know what they're supposed to do, but it's the doing that's the tough part. So that's what we try to step in and help and hold their hand and make it as easy for them as possible. Like I said, you know, our focus is on blood sugar stabilization, but we also want to break that cycle of sugar and processed carbohydrate addiction, which is alive and well. And to help people reclaim their health with an alkalizing type of a food plan that they can live with for the rest of their life.
My mother, when I was in my early teens, was on a program called Weight Watchers. And that program was, in a way, sort of based on the diabetic exchange diet, but not really for diabetics. However, many of the principles, reduced simple carbohydrates, reduced starch, were cornerstones of that. I'm sure you're familiar with it. Does your approach resemble that, or is it different? And if so, in what ways?
The Weight Watcher model is more of a group type of a setting. We see all of our clients one-on-one, mm-hmm. and individualized. We custom make programs for people, so it's not that one size fits all. Definitely, blood sugar stabilization is the umbrella, but we have gluten-free plans, vegetarian plans, vegan plans, plans for children, plans for sugar addiction, plans for fluid retention. We have 100 different food plans, and we don't count points. We look at food groups, and we try to get people thinking more that, you know, okay, half your plate should be vegetables and a quarter should be protein and another quarter should be the starch. Fat on the side is a condiment, salad dressing, nuts, and then the fruit that way, rather than counting points, because I just can't advocate a program that would let you eat a brownie for breakfast and count your points. I just don't see that as an end to the solution here.
Yeah, I agree. I think it's mutated quite a lot over the almost 50 years that we're talking about, from to the points thing, and certainly the prepackaged foods that many, I think, you know, Jenny Craig and some of these other diet plans, when I look at those nutritionally, one of the things I see is that, first of all, there's a lot of chemical additives and preservatives and other materials of dubious provenance, let's say, and not really much value added there. I see a lot of things like maltodextrin added for flavor. And the, you know, anytime you take a living food and you cook it and package it and give it a shelf life of 3 or 4 weeks or maybe three or four years.
Yeah.
Okay. Fair enough. You're really getting away from it as actual food. Michael Pollan, an author I follow very closely, calls them food-like substances.
Absolutely.
Yeah, and I've noticed a proliferation of that. But before we get into that, any additional thoughts?
Well, yes. Like what you were saying is the. You know, some of these foods are basically portion control. It doesn't mean that they're necessarily healthy for you. And, you know, I don't try to talk bad about other programs. It's just, I would never offer food like that. We're trying to get people back into the wholeness of food and all of this Frankenstein food. I mean, right now we're seeing it with all of the new burgers that are coming that are the vegan burgers. I mean, it might be a nice bridge, but it's certainly, you're not going to call that health food, a lot of that stuff. High sodium, more processing. I mean, that's what we have to get away from, is all this processed stuff.
Yes, I agree.
And the other thing about Weight Watchers, which is now goes by WW, you know, it's a multinational conglomerate on the stock market, right? I mean, the Healthy Way is a little mom and pop joint that, you know, it started locally. All the employees are local. It's right here in Santa Cruz. So it's not a big national chain or anything. So we can give much more personalized attention.
Well, it sounds like there's probably a little bit of psychology. I think it's fair to say that people eat a lot of what they eat, not because they're hungry, but because they're filling up some other empty box in their head. And as a result, the one-on-one approach may get to a lot of that. Let me ask you about any correlations you're aware of between adverse childhood events, perhaps abuse or threatened abuse, and having food as emotional comfort issues. Do you think that there's an association there that you're aware of?
Without question. I mean, food is love, and food can offer protection. So many women and men that have been sexually assaulted in their youth or in their life, you know, use food to build a wall around them, a safety net. Mm-hmm. I mean, we know that obesity and even overeating, compulsive overeating, I mean, it's a multifactorial issue. There's just, I mean, for me, every time I did something good, you know, they took me for ice cream. Oh, good girl. You know, here's a cake. Things like that. So I'm wired for, you know, sweets equals.
So you're on basically a little Skinnerian reward pathway there.
So many people, that's the case. I mean, and we're talking about a basic primitive brain here, right? I mean, we're wired for sweets. And that endorphin center just bing, bing, bing with that stuff. So it's a big problem.
Do you offer any thoughts at this point about gastric surgery, various types like Lap-Band? Do you take care of patients who've had gastric bypasses? And what are the challenges that they face in working with you?
Oftentimes, we have people shopping they say that their doctors told them to go get, bariatric surgery, but they just want to come and see what we have to offer. And many times we sign them up. But a lot of times people just want that quick fix and think, oh, good, I'm going to go get my stomach amputated, as you so eloquently referred to before. And I'm surprised at how many people come back to the healthy way that have already had that surgery. Maybe they've lost 50 pounds and then it suddenly stops and they still need to learn how to eat. Whether their pouch is, you know, half the size it used to be, if they're shoving Oreos in there. I mean, so many of them report that they can only eat a tiny amount and then they feel nauseous or they actually have reflux.
Right.
I'm sure it's helped some people. The super morbidly obese that are, you know, having, I mean, death is the next juncture that they're going to be facing. But I can't get behind that surgery. I think it's a big price to pay when, in fact, they still have to learn how to eat afterward.
Well, I want to amplify on that a little bit. I mean, you make a really good point. But afterwards, the type of eating and the ability after a gastric bypass, some of the normal digestive function is really disrupted. And the two things that we see a lot of at the 10-year mark, which I'm finding really frightening now, because as this starts to become more and more common, I'm thinking that we've got a tsunami of this sort of forming offshore outside of our event horizon, if you will, is osteoporosis and osteopenia, because the absorption of calcium is pretty significantly affected. And also neuropathy, and possibly, at least in genetically susceptible individuals, increased dementia, which, of course, is a dreadful price to pay for losing weight to develop dementia down the line. And that comes from problems with absorbing the B12, which is stomach dependent. And people are required to take very high doses of supplements, and they receive post-surgical consultation. But studies that have been looking at, well, let's put it this way. When you study patient compliance with anything, it's like the compliance slope, if you were to graph it on a curve, looks a little bit like a double black diamond ski slope. Very, very steep at the top, and then slowly tailing off. So what I mean is that people are compliant for 5 months, 6 months maybe, and then they start, it's a pain in the butt to take all of the supplements, and they sort of think that they're done, they're healed, they don't need them anymore. And even the best programs are down to annual checkups after the first 2 years. So it's not like you're going in and getting counseling and getting your blood tests checked. And I've not seen through the Family Physicians Academy any education from them about how I should be managing it. And they give us lots of education about what to watch for in the post-breast cancer patient who's had chest radiation, and how to manage the preventative care of a person who had childhood cancer. And they'll publish articles, which are really excellent, because they look at what are the long-term risks of something and what do we have to be on, have a higher threshold to identify. Because in medicine, it's the unknown, to paraphrase one of a famous politician, that gets you. And if we don't know to watch for something, or it's not disclosed because it's unknown, then we find out when people start falling off of particular cliffs, like the ramping up osteoporosis that's showing up about 10 years out from these bypasses, and also the neuropathy.
Have you heard, I read this somewhere, that the bariatric surgery patients have some of the highest new alcoholism rate. Have you heard anything about this?
I haven't, but it doesn't surprise me, because it goes back to that dopamine loop that you were talking about. If you are unable to eat to the point of getting that sort of fullness, part of what you're getting when your stomach is very full is you're getting increased parasympathetic tone. So you have the fight or flight, and you have the rest and digest. And the rest and digest piece, you can force it to happen by getting very, very full. The stomach just says, all right, I'm taking the wheel and I got to digest this. Or you throw it up. So people who can't pop into parasympathetic in a really nervous making situation, they'll vomit and they'll clear the pathway. They'll also have, they'll just clear the tube, so to speak, and get ready for fight or flight. And so those are the two extreme reactions. So you're forcing a parasympathetic reaction, which is also called mend and befriend. Mm-hmm. So that's when we do our healing. That's when we do our detoxification. That's when we do our social, positive social interaction. If you stop and think about it, so much of our positive social interaction is around food. You go out for coffee and maybe you have a little snack with the coffee, but you don't just meet someone at a park bench. You meet them at a cafe.
Or a bar.
Mm-hmm. One thing that you can do with an amputated stomach is you can absorb alcohol. It's not a parasympathetic response, but it's the next best thing, which is an alcoholic-induced relaxation.
And it also is given feeding their sugar craving.
You know, I'm sure it is. Alcohol, at least, you know, if you're talking about, it depends on what form you're drinking. Mm-hmm. There's a fair amount of residual carbohydrate in beer. There's substantially less in a dry white wine. There's absolutely nothing in a distilled alcohol. So if a person is drinking scotch and soda or, you know, any alcohol in water, they're not really getting any sugar. Mm-hmm. And what they're getting is alcohol, which is a neurotoxin, not so great. But part of the intoxication of that neurotoxin is to make you feel good. Mm-hmm. And as you said, people are eating for comfort. If they can't eat for comfort, alcohol is an easy switch. And so you could say that under those circumstances, it's a logical switch because, again, this speaks to the real problem. The unmet emotional needs of the individual have not been addressed. We may not be able to fix their body if they're at 450 pounds and can barely move. It's not like they can exercise. And the feedback loops from the actual fat cells themselves are going to drive a high food consumption unless you do something to disenable it. So in that situation, the person is like trapped in a tornado and you're just basically nuking the tornado to stop it. But then you're left with a lot of debris. And unless you have a plan for picking up that debris, probably the individual is not going to spontaneously come back together as, you know, a whole and fully integrated entity. That's one of the reasons why I thought that we would switch to this, because you do psychological counseling effectively. I don't know what the qualification is of your coaches, so mm-hmm. I don't want to make it sound like they're doing psychiatry.
And they aren't.
How are your coaches trained? What are they trained to do?
We are not therapists, any of us, so we are not offering psychological therapy. However, we're available 6 days a week. So the clients can come in every single day if they want. And, you know, we talk about habits. We're kind of doing maybe some easy cognitive behavioral kind of thing. It's a heavy on support. All of the coaches have been successful through the Healthy Way program. Some of them have a nutrition background. Others are more specialized in exercise. Some of them went to culinary school, so they really have the recipe type thing down pat. But again, we are not doing therapeutic counseling. But when you're seeing people on a frequent basis, you can kind of start understanding it's peer counseling is what we're doing.
And are the people who are doing the counseling, how do you choose them?
I need little motivational powerhouses. I need the cheerleaders. I need the people that see the glasses half full. I need the kind of employees that can instill hope and continuing belief in our clients. Totally non-judgmental type people. People that just love others and want to help them get to their goals.
You have how many people who provide this sort of counseling?
Six.
Six. Mm-hmm. So you said it isn't group oriented. Do people ever spontaneously form like little support groups for each other? I would think that would be just a phenomenon that would emerge in this setting.
We do have support group. And if people want to add that, you know, to their program, We do cooking classes frequently, and we get 30, 35 people out in our classroom, and they are all sharing ideas and thoughts. We've organized walking groups before. So we have a bulletin board, a community bulletin board, and we can form groups like that. But a lot of times they find that just meeting with their counselor, people are so busy these days that they find that the one-on-one is, they really like it.
So Cherie, let's take a moment and do what we call a compare and contrast in English literature class. You mentioned some of the principles of your diet, which was to say at least 50% of your dietary intake is going to be vegetables. About how many servings of vegetables would that be, and what size would the servings be?
That could be, you know, 3 to 5 servings. 1 cup
is a serving.
It's a serving.
So 3 to 5 cups.
Mm-hmm. But of course, that depends on the person's size.
Oh, yes, of course.
Yeah. I mean, that's a basic.
Mm-hmm. We would call that at least 6/10 or something like that. So we're going to get a proportion. So if we're thinking in terms of the dinner plate, then it's more than half or more of the dinner plate is going to be vegetables. Mm-hmm. So that helps with the visualization. If I eat a big salad, how does leafy greens compare to a different type of vegetable, something that's a little denser like broccoli or carrots, for example? Would it be 2 to 1, so twice as much leafy greens to?
Well, I mean, if it's iceberg lettuce leafy greens,
yeah,
no,
that's
mostly water. I mean, there's not a whole lot of nutrients in leafy greens. Romaine, I believe, has got the highest amount of good stuff in the lettuce world.
But how do we measure it? How do we measure romaine relative to something that's denser like carrots? Do we just take the romaine and cram it into a cup and figure out how much romaine it takes to cram down into a cup once, and then that's how we do it?
You know, basically we say unlimited vegetables. You asked me for an amount, but on our program, vegetables are unlimited. People can have as much leafy greens as they want. They can have as much broccoli as they want. There's a few that are higher on the glycemic index, like corn and beets and rutabaga and peas, that we kind of limit. But all the other ones have as much as you want.
Okay, so it sounds like it's fairly free form is kind of how I'm hearing it.
In the vegetable department,
right.
Yes. I mean, that's not so in fats or in carbs.
Okay.
And what we do is body composition analysis testing.
Uh-huh.
And then we get some data to figure out which food plan to put each person on based on their height, weight, sex, age, body composition, how much fat they have.
So you're measuring percentage body fat.
Yes.
And also percentage lean body mass.
Mm-hmm.
And what would be some of the break points? So let's suppose a person comes in. Let's take the same person. They weigh 200 pounds.
Mm-hmm.
We weren't going to worry about their height.
Mm-hmm.
And they come in and they're at 25% body fat and they want to lose weight. They're at 35% body fat.
Yeah, so that's more. How 25 can be, well, 18 to 25 for a woman is
good.
Pretty much of a norm. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, if someone were super muscular, they might actually still manage that.
Exactly.
And how would you, well, let's stick with the person that's 35% body fat. Give me what would be the break point so that you would just prescribe differently or that you would recommend differently. So who would get a different diet from that? That sounds like what the more typical patient gets.
The much more petite, smaller type of a person. Children would have less. A big old linebacker man, you know, would of course get lots more.
And when you say lots more, mm-hmm. what does that mean?
Well, like,
lots more
instance,
calories? Lots more?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Like, for instance, let's take the 200-pound person.
Does the proportion, before you do that, I want to be sure I've articulated my question. Does the proportion of food components, and we're talking about vegetables, carbohydrates, do you separate out legumes or do you consider them a vegetable?
We consider them a starch, actually.
Okay, mm-hmm. So you consider them a starch. So there we have legumes, which are also a good protein source.
Right.
So we're going to categorize them as starch because we're glycemic oriented.
Exactly.
Okay. So what would be the situation where a person would get a different mix Or is there ever? Is it just the volume, but the mix stays the same? You see what I'm asking?
Mm-hmm. The bones of our program, we don't want anybody eating high glycemic fruit, for instance. So bananas and
pineapples.
And, you know, the higher glycemic fruit, everybody. But a big, the linebacker man might get 4 or 5 fruit servings a day, where the little petite lady may get only 2. But it's of the same categories. So in other words, everybody gets the same binder, but the amounts might be very different based on body composition.
Right. Now I understand. Mm-hmm. That clarifies. A lot of current diets that are making the rounds are, of course, very different, and they're very popular right now. Lots of people are cleaning up on internet websites selling you, let's go with keto friendly foods. And back before that, it was, before keto became the watchword, it was Atkins friendly during the second revival of Atkins. What was that, about 4 or 5 years ago?
Right.
Your take on that kind of a diet, what you've observed, certainly what your clients have said about their experiences. Why don't you share that with our audience?
Gosh, I remember being on Dr. Atkins' Diet Revolution like in 1975 or something
That's about right.
You know, I remember that, yes, you do lose weight on it.
It's a low glycemic diet. You've got to hand that to them.
Yes, it is. And then, at least for me and what I've seen in the last 34 years, because, I mean, I've seen everything from Herbalife and every powder, everything that could ever pass. Remember when fat is what makes you fat? And then everything was had to be low carb, and everything had to be no sugar. And I mean, it's just such a good marketing ploy, you know, because it sells books and it sells packages of food. What I'm seeing with keto is I have lots of people come back in and say to me, oh my God, I've been on keto. I lost 30 pounds and now I've gained 45. They always gain more back. And it's like any program, I'm sorry, again, I don't try to talk bad about programs, but the logic of saying you can eat all the bacon you want, but don't have an apple, I just can't, it just doesn't make sense to me.
I think it's certainly very unbalanced. Therapeutically, I will say that these extreme diets have some interesting effects on the brain, and there are circumstances where they appear kind of paradoxically to have a very strong anti-inflammatory benefit. But this is generally with dementing diseases and with seizure disorders. I have also seen some very, very brittle diabetics, and let me take a moment and explain what brittle diabetic means to our audience. So a person who is, particularly if they are insulin dependent and must have insulin to live, is required to calculate, and even with the modern devices which read your blood sugar, there's a certain amount of crystal ball anticipation going on, trying to figure out how much insulin you're going to need in a day. And in the situation that happens in a brittle diabetic, they have broad fluctuations of their blood sugar. So they will they will eat something and shoot up very high. Their blood sugar might go up to 300 or even higher, and they'll use some insulin, and then that insulin will work. Possibly the dose is just right, but often the dose is a little too much. And the blood sugar will drop to, let's say, below 60, which is where you start to lose nerve cells. And people can actually go into a coma from too much insulin. It's a very uncomfortable feeling. And so typically, first thing people do is they drink some orange juice. Usually they drink a glass of orange juice, which is way too much to fix that blood sugar low. And now they're back into a high, and they're trying to bring that down. So these broad fluctuations are very, very hard on the body physiologically. There's also, as I said, there's a physiologic response. The adrenal gland, sensing the imminent seizure, will put out a ton of epinephrine and a ton of cortisol, the stress hormones. And those, and stress hormones always raise blood sugar. That's part of what they do. They cause the body to break down muscle, cause the liver to turn protein into fat. And so you will get some glucose into the bloodstream, but at the expense of this very difficult to attain tissue we call muscle tissue. So a typical brittle diabetic, if you look at them physically, they have pipe stem arms and legs, as they're called, and a big round belly because of the high insulin and the fact that they periodically cannibalize their muscle. So this is a really bad loop, and it can lead to an extremely unstable situation. I have seen when you take a person like that and you take away all carbohydrate and you just feed them fat for even a day, their insulin requirements drop really dramatically. And so, and then you can you could start refeeding them and use protein and vegetables and stay away from the high glycemic foods that require insulin for digestion and actually yank them out of that downward spiral. But that level of therapeutic diet requires a very sophisticated team with a physician, a dietitian. It's a classic children don't try this at home, and don't try this because the guy on the internet selling coffee tells you to. Because, well, obviously, if you're getting medical advice from an ad on TV, that's probably not a good source. If you're getting drug advice from somebody's blog on the internet, which is attached to a store, that's probably not very good either. What about some of the other diets? What's your thought on South Beach? Is South Beach a pretty good kind of plan? That was a high vegetable.
And it kind of has come and gone.
Well, I mean, like all diet books do.
You know, my philosophy, and I feel like I'm legitimate in saying this since I've been sitting there in that same chair for 34 years. I don't believe that anything that you do to lose weight that cannot be continued through your life, it's going to give you the results. I mean, back to keto for a minute, you know, the thought of never eating carbs again, that's ridiculous. I mean, that's
intrinsically not likely.
Right.
Nobody's going to be able to manage that for their life, but it works really well if you can control somebody else's intake, but you can't control your own. You'd need somebody controlling you, what you could eat in order to be on that long term.
And the other thing that we didn't touch on with a lot of the present day of what I call fad diets, it's more part of the problem. Eating tons of protein food on our planet right now doesn't make sense. You can get some of those same results from a plant-based diet. Last night, I just went and saw Dr. Grigger talk on How Not to Die, right? Mm-hmm. And he and Dr. Furman and all of the guys that are plant-based guys, they'll show you documentation that shows the diabetics never needed all that fat and protein, and that they can lose weight and get their insulin stabilized from a plant-based diet. And it does a lot less harm to the planet with all of the, you know, carbon emission and all that stuff. I mean, I just don't think that programs that advocate eating, you know, half your body weight in beef and, you know, ham hocks is, it's just more part of the problem.
Yeah, I think you make your points very well, great vehemence. So I think at this point, I want to ask you to advise us in terms of what you think are the core principles. If we haven't covered them, I think what I'll just repeat what I've heard. I've heard the majority of foods that you eat should be plant-based, low glycemic, like vegetables, that you should eat multiple times a day and not just have a single meal, that you should be looking at organic food and plant-based sources of protein. Have I missed anything important there?
We're not trying to make everyone be plant-based, just more plant-friendly. For people that don't want to give up their meat and fish and chicken, that's our core program. We do have a plant-based program. We have a vegan program. We have a vegetarian program. We have a dairy-free program. I mean, it's whatever somebody wants to achieve. And sometimes along the way, we'll notice, hey, I think you might have an allergy to dairy. Why don't we do an elimination diet here? So we can do experimenting with people. And a lot of times they finally come up with, finally, I found how I need to be fueling my body. And it's really rewarding.
Do you notice people having physical symptoms that disappear frequently?
Always. Within 2 weeks. so many people that are type 2 diabetics that can get off of insulin.
Oh, yeah.
We have lots of people with their blood pressure pills. Goodbye. They don't need to take them anymore.
What are some of the other symptoms that often disappear?
Skin rashes.
Uh-huh.
Definitely eczema and skin type of things. It's a low inflammatory program. So anything that, you know, that
aches and pains, arthritis.
Plus skin starts really glowing better. Mood elevates dramatically.
Sheree, I want to thank you so much for coming and sharing with us your program. I have known about it since I first came to town, and I have always thought it was an eminently sensible and healthy, you know, core healthy approach to food. And of course, nothing that I've learned in subsequent years has disabused me of that. I appreciate, and I'm sure my audiences appreciate, the chance to have heard from you. Any last words of wisdom for us?
Well, Christmas is over. Holidays are over. It's all fun and games until your pants don't fit, right? So just give us a call. Come on in for a consultation. They're completely free. Most of our clients are losing 2 to 3 pounds a week, eating safe, sensible, healthy food that they can eat for the rest of their life.
All right. Well, thank you very much for coming on the program.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Bye. And we're going to move to a couple of news stories, and then I've got a couple of emails to read. So let's start with hypertensive medications. Taking those at night turns out to be much healthier than taking them during the day. There's been small studies, but you know what happens with small studies is that people say, well, you know, it needs to replicate. Well, folks, it's been replicated. A Spanish team randomized more than 19,000 primary care patients with hypertension to take their medication regimen either at bedtime or on awakening. And at baseline, the two groups had similar blood pressure levels, physiologic comorbidity, laboratory tests, and cholesterol values. They were followed rigorously, and I do mean rigorously. They did a 48-hour ambulatory blood pressure measurement at least annually, and they followed them for 6.3 years. The endpoints were what they call a composite cardiovascular-related death, a heart attack, revascularization like a bypass, heart failure, or stroke. So those are the, of course, things that having hypertension set you up for, not a pretty list. And there was a very significant difference in the bedtime group, a relative reduction of 50%. So as we said, all of those bad things happened to 11.9%, call it 12%, of the group that took the pills on waking up, and 6.5%, so a little more than half of the group that took them at bedtime. This was across the board, all of the things from stroke to heart attack, all reduced by about the same thing. And there were no side effects of being faint or falling out of bed when they tried to wake up in the morning. If a drug came along that reduced this sort of thing by this level of proportion, by almost 50% reduction, you'd be seeing ads every 10 seconds. This would be absolutely all over the news. But here, it was kind of died without a trace after it was announced. This is, of course, not too surprising because it is a study that doesn't sell more medications and, in fact, might lead to people needing to take less. Okay, this is a case of doing vitamin research badly. No benefit for treating vitamin D deficiency in critically ill patients. Now, there has been some studies that suggested, and these were smaller trials using different doses, very important, that there might be a mortality benefit if you gave somebody who was in the intensive care unit some extra vitamin D if they were deficient. And so to test these hypotheses, this group of U.S. investigators came up with the most idiotic approach I've ever seen. They randomized 1,000 critically ill patients with a vitamin D level below 20, which is deficient in anybody's book, even a 30-year-old medical textbook, and they gave them a single dose of IV vitamin D3, which was 540,000 international units. That is 100 times more vitamin D than your body, well, probably at the maximum your body can make, about 10,000 units of vitamin D a day. Now, in my book, since you're treating here with a hormone and not a vitamin, actually, you probably don't want to give 50 times more hormone. So let me give you an analogy here. Their experimental design was the same thing as seeing if we could prevent pregnancy in women by giving them 30 birth control pills, the entire month's supply of birth control pills, on the first day of the month. And then the following day of the month, we'll give them another 30 birth control pills. And we'll see if that prevents pregnancy. It's going to mess the patient up. And that's exactly what happened. There was no benefit in length of stay, ventilator-free days, or mortality in the group that received the overdose of vitamin D. This was just a stupid trial. And it's an example, yet again, of how bad study, if you want to prove that something doesn't work, you can easily manage it by giving the wrong dose at the wrong time, and well, it won't work. I wanted to get this one out. This came in today. This is from Anonymous in Santa Cruz. Subject, how to handle my new heart condition. I'm so glad you're back on the air. I'm trying to get into the Wednesday night habit of listening, and I even set my phone alarm to go off at 6 p.m. last week. Your great info and analysis are a rare and valuable resource. Now, about my heart, I'm in a quandary as to what to do. Apparently, I don't have intermittent atrial fibrillation, as my family doctor has concluded after many tests. She wants to ask her question, but let's go for the history. I'm going to reword this. She had palpitations in October, which is skipped heartbeats. She went to her doctor who did some blood tests and checked her thyroid. Then she had a monitor. This is called a Zio, and you wear it on your body and it monitors what your heart does. And it showed some weird runs. She got an echocardiogram and an EKG. And basically, she was diagnosed as having intermittent atrial fibrillation. I want to tell you for a moment that if you look up atrial fibrillation and stroke, what you'll see is a statement that people with atrial fibrillation have a 3% annual risk for stroke. And actually, of course, that depends on your risk factors. Might be a bit higher if you have hypertension, or you have, or you're taking, let's say, estrogen replacement orally. Might be a bit lower if you have no risk factors for heart disease in the first place. Something called lone AFib, and people with lone AFib, healthy people with AFib and nothing else, actually have a substantially lower stroke risk, and so much lower, in fact, that their risk of having a complication from blood thinners is getting about to be the same as their risk of the stroke. But nevertheless, the 3% figure is what's in every doctor's head, and I want to emphasize that's for chronic atrial fibrillation. So far as I know, there is very, very little data on intermittent atrial fibrillation. A person with a 2-week Zio who had a few weird runs, if they were in fact atrial fibrillation, and they may not have been, would still probably be at a very, very low risk for having a stroke. And so you have to question whether or not there's any reason whatsoever to take blood thinners. Getting back to Anonymous's question. Today, I got my appointment with a highly recommended cardiac specialist who suggested 3 or 4 different meds until I insisted I really do not want to do meds unless I really have to. I do realize that stroke is a big risk. Well, not so much. Then he looked over my chart a little more and said I didn't have atrial fib, but rather palpitations, which is to say extra beats, not atrial fib. The reason this is important is because atrial fib is the only condition where part of the heart isn't moving. It's just sitting there and quivering. And in that quiver chamber, the blood can clot. In palpitations, which are extra early beats, all of the chambers squeeze and clear the blood. So there's no stagnant blood. So there's no stroke risk. The doctor wants to implant a loop monitor under my chest skin. It's quick and easy, and he can monitor it from his office. I'd like your opinion on this monitor. I like it a heck of a lot better than the meds. I did Eliquis for 2 days and got pretty sick for a week. He set me up for next Tuesday. I've decided that's too quick. I need to do some research, like asking your opinion, which is why you pop to the top of the line, anonymous, because it sounded like you're on a time condition. He also said more magnesium, 62 milligrams three times a day. Not a bad idea. That's a pretty modest dose of magnesium. I'll use amounts up to 1,000 a day without worrying. Anything, I break up that dose so you don't get diarrhea. You can monitor red blood cell magnesium, which will tell you about tissue levels if you're worried about getting magnesium toxic, but it's really not a thing. You can get magnesium toxic with IV magnesium. I think we talked about that last week. I'd love to hear any of your ideas about the possibility of reversing heart problems. I'm somewhat familiar with plant-based ideas, not very knowledgeable about natural blood thinners, that type of thing. I've become a vegan, boring, since this started, and I think the palpitations are less. That's probably because she's getting more potassium and magnesium. I feel fine, regular good energy. My sleep can be a problem. Acupuncture's helping with that. So what's going on here? Well, first of all, lots of things can cause palpitations, and one of the chief ones is stress. As we get older, we're more vulnerable to cardiac irritability from stress. So the first thing that Anonymous needs to do is start meditating. If you aren't already doing some kind of regular relaxation meditation, there's all kinds of classes. You can also listen to relaxation tapes. You can buy one of these biofeedback devices that they sell on the internet, like HeartMath. It has one called Inner Balance that hooks onto your phone. It's the one I use. Otherwise, I have no ore in the water, so to speak, about which one of these you use. But something to bring you down a couple times a day for 5 to 10 minutes would be very useful. Get that adrenaline down. The other thing I would recommend to anyone with palpitations is taurine, which is an amino acid that stabilizes the heart muscle and makes it less likely to try to behave like a pacemaker. Doses for that, about 4,000 to 5,000 milligrams a day. That's 4 to 5 grams. Sounds like a lot, but remember, it's an amino acid, so it is not a very significantly high dose, actually. And I've had lots of patients with palpitations who cleared up on taurine, so I always try that first right out of the box. So my recommendations would first of all be, You're talking about implanting a new invasive device to monitor your heart in order to prove that you don't need a blood thinner that you almost certainly don't need in the first place. But let's be really rational here, and let's have you do the taurine and do some magnesium and do some meditation and see how your symptoms go. And maybe even get another Zio monitoring and see whether those funny runs, whatever they were, have gone away. If they have, then problem solved, and you don't need blood thinners, and you didn't need to have an invasive procedure to improve monitoring. I suspect there's a hefty profit margin built into that, not to say that it's not a good thing, but it seems a little overkill in your case. Our next email with a little bit of good advice I wanted to share with you comes from Matt in Raleigh, North Carolina. Dear Dr. Don, I'm a longtime podcast listener, and I appreciate all you do. I have an anecdotal tip that some of your listeners might find useful, and I'm curious about the broader implications. I've suffered from dyshidrotic eczema for most of my 43 years and managed it with daily use of steroid creams. I read a suggestion on a forum that evening primrose oil might help, so I started taking 1,200 milligrams a day, and my eczema cleared up within a week. I haven't used steroids in 2 years. I've gotten slack about taking it a few times and the symptoms return, so I'm fairly sure this is not a placebo effect. I tried high-dose fish oil and vitamin E before I tried this. No impact on the eczema. I hope you find this useful. I'm curious if you have any thoughts on broader implications. I'm assuming I have some kind of single nucleotide polymorphism that makes some aspect of fatty acid metabolism inefficient, possibly prostaglandin production or some structural component of the skin. Primrose oil is particularly rich in gamma-linoleic acid, and that is, by the way, where we're going to go with this on my response. What about fish oil? I'm currently taking 1,000 milligrams a day. I have some family history of dementia, and I hope to avoid that for myself. So aside from the topical steroid, I'm healthy, and I am not using that because I no longer need it. So let's talk a little bit, and Matt, thank you. First of all, I'm going to tell people what dyshidrotic eczema is, because there might be people out there who haven't, don't know they've got it. It is a type of eczema you get on your hands, and it starts out with little tiny pinpoint blisters, And these blisters then break open, and then you have little pinpoint raw spots, just like when a blister peels, which hurt. And they typically happen on the hands. They like the backs of the hands and the skin folds. They're made worse by soap, any kind of soap and any kind of detergent, which is why we think it does have something to do with the fatty layer that's the protective layer on the skin. And I have a hypothesis here. The dose of evening primrose oil that you're taking, 1,200 milligrams, probably supplies about close to 1,000 milligrams of gamma-linoleic acid. That's one of the healthy omega-6s. And they are the sole backbone for producing a class of compounds called resolvins. These are anti-inflammatory compounds that act as part of a feedback loop in all of the elaborate inflammatory cascades. So it is important to get your omega-3s, but it's also important to get some good omega-6s. And you're right, you may have a specific kink in your DNA that makes you more vulnerable to this sort of thing. Staying away from detergents, washing your hands in water, particularly hand sanitizers, are very bad. On the dementia front, I wanted to say exercising, no medications are all a good start on not getting dementia. I would also include the fish oils. I think that getting 1,000 milligrams of DHA, which is probably more than you're getting currently, would be very good for your brain, and that's the dose I shoot for myself, based on some science and some extrapolation, a little bit of both. Two other bits that are really important for avoiding dementia: keep your teeth and your gums very, very healthy. You don't need inflammation. And I recently talked about a certain bacteria which seems to be showing up in amyloid plaque when you look for its DNA. And it's a tooth gum inflammatory bacteria. And the other thing is treating herpes. If you get oral herpes, I recommend taking a suppressive drug every day in order not to get oral or genital herpes, because herpes virus shows up in amyloid plaque. And we're beginning to understand that amyloid is like a kind of a scab. It forms where there's inflammation, and you don't want inflammation. Well, that's about all for this week's podcast. Please go to AskDrDawn.com for news about our future plans, or follow my tweets at AskDrDawn. For now, this is Dr. Dawn saying so long and stay healthy.
Ask Dr. Dawn is brought to you by Jiva Media. Production and editing by Charles Mansky. Music by John Scoville.